Welcome back to the Centrist Shikakers podcast. I am your basic podcast coming to you from his closet. Yeah, back again already. I know. Pretty crazy, right? Well, crazy shit keeps happening, so I got to come back and talk about it. Or maybe that's the reason I don't come around that often, really, is this Trump presidency has been absolutely wild, much like the first one. Maybe not quite as divisive, which seems weird to say this time around. Never mind it. It is. They still hate him. They can't stand him. But I think it was what made the first one stand out more was the Russiagate stuff and the shock that Hillary Clinton just didn't get what she deserved by getting elected to presidency after Obama. She was the next up. And Trump pulled that rug out from underneath your feet. But that's one of the reasons I don't come back that often. Things are changing too much. It's almost, you know, it is overwhelming, maddening at times. Sean, who you should check us out when we get together, you can find us over at the ground level, anywhere you find your podcasts. Usually he has his own episodes up. I'll usually, whenever I get around to doing one, we'll throw one up there. So, go give us a follow or whatever. Comment, please. Actually, that's one thing I really wanted to bring out. Let me just start with that. If you leave some comments, it's not about the ratings or anything like that. I don't really care. But if you do leave a comment or a question, I mean, I'll talk about it. I mean, we can literally have a debate back and forth. I would love that. I mean, I'd like to talk to more people. So, but anyways, the chaos is one of the reasons I don't come around all that often, just because it's too much. I mean, yeah, you could go, it's all sorts of material. You could talk about this. You never talked about Doge. I mean, there's so many different things. I mean, Sean and I did, but I didn't really go into it too deep here. I don't remember, I don't think. So, yeah, but it's also, it's just too much. But obviously I come back for war. I mean, it's kind of a big deal and didn't want to let that pass me by. But here I am, coming to you to say I was wrong. A little humility here from your center shit kicker, because currently, I mean, things obviously could change. Here I am saying how chaotic it is, and now I'm going to rest my laurels on the fact that we have a ceasefire between Israel and Iran that they both attempted to blow up in the hours before the ceasefire took place. They were launching more attacks that pissed Trump off, which was pretty hilarious to hear him drop the F-bomb. I think the quote was, these two countries don't know what the fuck they're doing. Pretty hilarious to hear Trump say that, actually. And so, yeah, I had to come back now just to kind of eat the crow that it's being served to me about this whole regime change thing, I suppose. But, you know, I also want to justify some of my concerns here. You know, of course, because, you know, I can't be totally wrong, right? I mean, I lose all legitimacy as a day laborer. No experts here. First off, it's great we have a ceasefire, so I'm not going to argue that. Even I don't know what's going to happen out of this. I don't know what reforms are going to happen, if there's deals going to be made. Obviously, that's all in the offing here. The ceasefire opens the door to many other pathways, obviously, that don't involve war, you hope. So this is a good thing. But I guess I asked the question, though, was the ceasefire inevitable? Like, other things we could have gone in different directions, right? Completely. I don't know. But were Israel's strikes and the president's decision to bomb the nuclear sites, was that strategy so profound, or was their intelligence so good that this conclusion of a ceasefire was like determinative? Like, they knew we were going to get a ceasefire based on those actions. I mean, that'd be awesome if it was. But, I mean, I think that's a pretty generous interpretation of their strategy. I mean, usually when he's dropping bombs and essentially what looks to be the start of an all-out war or regime change, it's the start of one, is what it looks like. You could go in a lot of different directions. Who says Iran backs down? Maybe they just go, fuck it, we're going all in on terrorist strikes, and we somehow try to activate the Houthis or Hezbollah or these things, or these other proxy groups that they have. Now, clearly, maybe, like I said, maybe the president's intelligence was that, no, these groups are not going to respond. We've isolated Iran. We have their airspace. We know all these. I mean, as I said, you can make the argument that their intelligence was so good, it provided them a strategy like, yes, we can shut this down. We can destroy their nuclear facilities or capabilities, which apparently are inconclusive currently. Now, some say that's an insult to our military, that it's inconclusive whether these places were truly destroyed, that all the nuclear materials were either buried or that they didn't get any out, that they weren't able to relocate any of the industrial material they have that they need to enrich uranium. Like, I don't know. Like, but there's a Reuters article I was just reading that said it was inconclusive. And like, some people are saying that's insulting to our military. I was like, no, maybe they did the best job humanly possible with the equipment given, but we just don't know what's down there. I mean, how can we now? It's buried under rubble, but we don't know. I mean, maybe they did. Like I said, maybe this intelligence was that great. I don't know. But I think it's a reasonable question to go, okay, is it absolutely conclusive, or are we just going to take your word for it, or is it possibly inconclusive based on just satellite imaging or something? I have no idea. Like I said, obviously they're not. I'm not in on any briefings. Shock to the world. So I think it's fair to just call it inconclusive, and really, I guess you just got to, you know, once again, as uncomfortable as it might be for skeptics like myself, just extend that olive branch of trust and say, okay, well, I'll trust you that that's destroyed them. Anyways, the point being, though, is could it have gone in a different direction is really what I'm getting at. We don't know. And honestly, as much as generous as I'm trying to be towards the president, the administration, and even Israel in this instance, I still feel like you can't be 100% on everything. There's no guarantees in life, right? So it certainly could have gone in a different direction. It still could, even with this ceasefire. I mean, last time we had a ceasefire from between Israel and Palestine, it only lasted like a month or something like that. So who knows how long this ceasefire lasts, where it leads. But, you know, I just feel like it could still go in another direction. I'm just not as confident as some people are. And by some people, I'm going to specifically reference Ben Shapiro right now. Listening to one of his episodes, like whenever I really want to get in touch with where baseline Republican thought is, Shapiro is my go-to because he makes, you know, arguments at times that make sense. I mean, I think that's his strength is, granted, I think he obfuscates sometimes, but he's going to give you the conservative religious outlook on as an American outlook as well. I might as well define it geographically, but he was pretty confident that there was going to be no regime change war. In fact, he went so far as to say this.
Proclaiming that this was all about regime change, that the United States was going to launch hundreds of thousands of troops into Iran the same way that we did in Iraq. That was always sheer absolute crap.
So, yeah, obviously all crap, apparently. Pretty confident that that there was going to be no regime change out of this. Well, I was not that confident, clearly. If you listened to the last episode, I've made that, you know, obvious. But, you know, that's not based on me living in some fantasy world. It's really based on me living in the last 25, 30 years since the war on terror began. We've been doing this stuff, and frankly, even Trump had his own little, you know, non-militaristic regime change attempt in Venezuela. Now, say what you want about that. It's a very complicated issue, but we had Juan Guaido here, this guy who essentially announced himself as interim president because, you know, some constitutional law Venezuela had and a questionable election. You know, does any of this sound familiar? So he tries to install himself as president over, good Lord, now I'm going to forget the guy's name. Not Castro. Castro is from Cuba. We got, who was it? Maduro. Sorry. Nicolas Maduro is the guy in Venezuela. He's still there because that coup, so to speak, or regime change through peaceful means did not work. The Venezuelans weren't having it, which is obvious. You know, when you start messing with someone's democracy, however legitimate that democracy is, people are going to rally around the flag, which, by the way, gets us right back to Iran. There was definitely a rally around the flag effect that these strikes could have had, especially against a longtime enemy like Israel. Now, granted, I don't know how united the Iranian people are around the regime, around hating Israel, or even around hating America. But I tell you what, decades-long propaganda campaign by a police state like they have in Iran, yeah, it's going to sway a lot of people or convince a lot of people. And so, you know, it's concerning. You had a country of 90 million people, even if 60% of them are around the regime, that's a lot. That could go in different directions, you know, and if the war stretches on, that effect only solidifies, I would have to imagine. So just based on our going into Afghanistan, going into Iraq, bombings in Syria, all the aid we give to other countries to fight their wars, the idea that this was going to be just a quick in and out, which apparently seems to be the case right now, which is amazing. This is not the outcome I would have put money on, honestly. So, you know, forgive me. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm just a guy. I'm trying to interpret all this stuff. But the other funny thing was in that same freaking episode that Shapiro said that all these worries about World War III or regime change are crap. He played this quote from Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. You tell me if this sounds like regime change talk or not.
Target Americans in the region or around the world. There are many more targets inside of Iran. So I cannot stress enough what President Trump has said, that they should not retaliate against our troops or American citizens anywhere if they want to continue in power.
You will not be in power. Well, that certainly sounds like a potential of going in and getting the regime to fall. One way or the other, whether it's just maybe it's just a complete missile war and there's never hundreds of thousands of troops on the ground, no Americans involved. I don't know. That's entirely possible, I suppose. But either way, it's regime change, however you want to slice it. So what are we supposed to do with that information? And like I said, that was funny that Shapiro played that in the very same podcast I played the quote from earlier, that he played that. And the idea that our fears about regime change interventionist war is just unfounded and stupid seems kind of funny in that light. And, you know, he goes on in this regard. I think in a preceding episode, he like put Dave Smith on blast. He put Tucker on blast because they all kind of shared the same concerns I have. And I think many Americans have that we're done with these wars and we want to avoid it. And I don't think our fears are unjustified, but you know, he's using this to then say these people are idiots. Go ahead and listen to him if you want, but we know what's going on here. And really the funny thing is he's, I'm just going to go ahead and be, you know, a little bit vicious, but he's really coddling Trump's balls on this one. Which is fine. I mean, if that's what you want to do, I guess I'd wear some protection, but, he's doing that because And I think the funny thing is he's also argued against this split in the MAGA coalition, Mr. Shapiro has, but he's also speeding this split in the MAGA coalition by attempting to throw out people like Tucker by saying that they're not worth listening to. I mean, it is a little bit of what is that? When peacocks fluff their feather, pruning, not pruning. Anyway, I can't think of what it is. But yeah, he's a little preening. He's a little bit preening about himself being right in this regard, that or maybe even post fact being correct, that the president's not going to go into some massive military occupation. But that only fuels the split, right? I mean, I'm sure Tucker is going to fire back. Tucker was on a show recently with Emily Jasinski. You can find it on YouTube. Just look her up. I think it's called After Dark. Where he just went nuclear on Mark Levin, like personally attacking him essentially as a neocon warmonger. But let's face it, these people are in the room with Trump. Now, granted, he doesn't have to listen to them, which is getting to the topic that I really want to dive into here. So you got Shapiro coddling Trump's balls and everyone else's hopes, the country's hopes, literally resting on this one man who's in the room with all these people who would love nothing more than a regime change. I'm hoping Shapiro is not at least that ignorant, because that would be ignorant, not just pie in the sky or rose colored glasses thinking. That would be ignorant to think that Trump isn't surrounded by some sort of neocons. Now, granted, there's been some isolationist presence within this administration, J.D. Vance, supposedly. Tulsi Gabbard, obviously. I'm hoping that they got some of their advice and got to consult with the president on these things. But you know there's war dogs in there, war hawks, I should say, or the same, whatever, war sharks, whatever, trying to convince the president it's a good idea that we do not relent until this regime is toppled, whatever it takes to then make sure to then go in and occupy these nuclear sites. We got to go and we got to make sure that we got everything. They can't leave any fissile material around, this and that. I mean, you know, some of these arguments were made. I mean, if I'm making them right now, more intelligent people with more power in those positions, I'm certain it's happened. But the idea that maybe it is Trump, maybe it's all Trump. Maybe Trump goes, no, I will not start this war. Maybe he's actually living up to his campaign promise, which would be wild. Now, granted, you go, well, he's already broke that promise by launching this attack. Okay, well, you know, okay, tit for tat, I suppose, or you want to you know, I'm going to live in the gray area, though. You want to draw that hard line. I don't think that hard line's there. He said he wouldn't start any wars. An attack isn't necessarily a war. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, you didn't start a war, but you certainly bombed somebody. He did that in his last administration, too, obviously, more than once. I think he dropped bombs on Syria as well as the Moab bomb, which we've discussed in the past. But either way, so he goes in. But that's not the point. Is we're putting all of our hopes on a president who has broad-ranging military powers these days. And then I go, well, where do these powers come from? Well, that gets us to looking at the rule book. I mean, it's not like I'm going to, you know, call the president up and say, hey, you actually can't do that, sir. I mean, you have a whole Congress who's supposed to be doing that. But let's start. And by the rule book, obviously, I mean the Constitution. That is the rule book for our country. And everyone can look at it. We can all read it. We can all interpret it. Let's not kid ourselves. So let's dive in here and look at this Constitution. Oh, maybe I should make it clear why we're going to the rule book here, our good old Constitution. It's really about the war powers thing. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, right? An attack on a foreign nation, just on the go-ahead of the American president. Now, granted, he is the commander-in-chief, but let's get into the nitty-gritty of the rules. Now, granted, the nitty-gritty of those rules have been augmented by the authorization of use of military force. I think that's the AUMF, passed in 2001, which essentially gave the president, I'm going to put it into a synopsis or a nutshell here. It's really just so he can act quickly as in regards to the war on terror. And apparently this war on terror is never ending. So you've essentially expanded what the Constitution says about war powers for the president. He can essentially authorize a strike immediately to take care of a potential terror threat, essentially like the what was that show with Kiefer Sutherland? He was Jack Bauer. 24, was that the name of the show? It's like it's constantly, you know, he's got to torture a terrorist to find out where the bomb is. You know, it's this constant thing. It's essentially that show in a bill where you get to make the president Jack Bauer do whatever's necessary to stop the terror attack or to kill these terrorists because they're going to bomb somebody or hijack another plane. More or less, that's the angle and the force behind the authorization of use of military force law. 2001. Thanks, War on Terror. Never stops. But the old school rules here, we're going to start with what Congress can do, because there's a few things here. I'm going to read these. This one's going to be a little longer than the second reading, but I want to read these because, once again, my concern is we're pinning all our hopes on one man. Now, granted, I will tip my cap to Trump. And as you know, I am more quick to criticize our president than I am to praise him. So in this instance, I'm going to praise him because whatever he did, whatever intelligence, whatever strategy was discussed, whatever war hawk he ignored and peaceful person in his administration, maybe J.D. Vance, I don't know, or Tulsi, whoever, he apparently listened to them or knew that this would lead to a better outcome or was pushing for it behind the scenes. We just don't know. We don't know. But ultimately, since so much of our power and certainly with our military, which is constantly in motion and constantly in action, resting in the president's hands, you can't avoid giving Trump some sort of credit in this instance. And I'm loath to do that. But since we're not currently moving in to occupy or we're not sending more bombs and everything else right now, I have to say, good job, Mr. President. So, you know, some of you get a kick out of that. It still concerns me, though. So this is the reason we're talking about this, because Trump could have gone in a different way. I'm circling back to the top of the episode here. Things could have happened differently that would force his hand in another direction, perhaps. Or we just don't have Trump. Maybe it's the next guy and he wouldn't have listened or stood his ground on principle or campaign promise and broke that promise and went in all in regime change and listened to the other advisors. So I think that's why we should be concerned with the rules, because Trump's not going to be around forever and we're still going to be subject to these people who never go away. How long have I heard Michael Bolton's name or Bill Kristol and all these other war hawks that are around D.C. at these think tanks or put into other positions within the executive branch? You know, it's like it's just crazy how these guys and women get recycled into new roles and they have the same ideology that we had back in the early aughts with just constant war on terror, constant regime change, and American, let's face it, it's just American imperialism. Whether you want to look at America that way or not, that's fine. You can try to color it up any other way you want, but that's in the arc of world history. Yeah, America's an empire, and this is what we do. This is what empires do. And the evidence is all right there before you, as much as we don't want to believe it. Anyways, I'm rambling. So we got to talk about these war powers and what they mean. So let's go back to the rule book. Finally, I'm going to start reading from it. This first section is long. This is from Article 1, Section 8, which is regards Congress. This is a few paragraphs down in Section 8. To declare, this is the Congress shall have power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water, to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. That's why we get a defense bill every 2 years. To provide and maintain a navy, to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. And, okay, so that's the end of, that all applies to, well, what you'd say is war and or the military. Those are the powers that Congress has. That was a long reading, no? Well, let me go to what the presidential powers are in Article 2. And this will not take nearly as long. And we're going to go into why this is all important. Section 1 of Article 2, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. He shall hold this office during the term of, I'm going to skip ahead. I screwed up. So I'm not going to edit that out because I'm not big on editing. It's Section 2, of Article 2 is the presidential war powers. Everything else is about how he was elected, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you can look it up yourself. This is not very difficult to find. At least it shouldn't be. It's our Constitution. Section 2 of Article 2. This is what matters. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. That's about it. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer of each executive department. So that just goes on to the departments. That's it. So really just like one sentence, and it kind of goes on. I got to tell you, the framers sometimes very confusing with their writing. I'm sure it was crystal clear to them, but these days this sort of writing is not. I mean, it goes all the way down to impeachment. Let me just read it for the sake of completion. Okay, we're going to start again. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states. When called into the actual service of the United States, he may require the opinion, in writing, of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. That was all one sentence. Okay, so why is this important? Well, as you can rewind back, I guess, that first reading of Section 8 in Article 1 regarding Congress's war powers, much more expansive, wouldn't you say? I mean, that was paragraphs long about very specific things about navies and armies and militias. By the way, we should talk about militias someday, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole right now. The president's was more or less, I mean, granted, that's a long-ass sentence, but the only part that really pertains to war powers is that he's in the commander-in-chief. So, he can do what he wants then. I mean, that's a very simplistic reading of it. If he's commander-in-chief, he does what he wants. He controls the Army and Navy. Fair, he does. However, Article 1, unless I'm mistaken, comes before Article 2. And if we're going to, and if you go, well, that doesn't matter. I think it does. And I think the framers knew it mattered. Because, as we constantly love to say on the ground level and other places, power derives from the people. And the branch of government that is closest or more closely related to the people having power is Congress. Now, granted, it's a bicameral Congress, so you have Senate for 6 years and your representatives in the House for two. But that's to create a churn of a body of government that is directly voicing the needs and wants and desires of the people. The president, now granted, has expansive powers, but it seems to me that if Congress isn't declaring war, a president doesn't get to override that part of the Constitution because he's the commander in chief. He's the commander in chief in times of war, which must be declared by Congress. No. So, I mean, all this gets muddied, like I said, by the AUMF. It's not clear anymore, you know, as much as it maybe was never clear based on the writing of our founders. Maybe it was never that clear, but it seems to me, even if you're the commander in chief, you must therefore be given those rights to move troops, to do warlike activities after war has been declared by Congress. Article 1 comes before Article 2. The Congress is closer to the power of the people than the president is. Now, granted, you can say, yes, the president is elected by the people. I would love to get into the unitary executive theory. And in fact, that's something I'd actually really want to talk about. I want to talk about it with Sean, too. To me, it's concerning. There's this whole no kings thing, but blah, 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 blah. I want to get sidetracked here. I guess my point being is right now, in this very instance with a ceasefire, this worked. But if we are in another situation where a president is exercising these powers without the will of the people, without the consent of the people through Congress, as stated in the Constitution, to me, that is a concern. Because, like I said, we will not always have Trump. Do you honestly believe that Kamala would have stood her ground on something like this? If Kamala Harris had been elected president and those war hawks had been in her ears, I have no doubt we wouldn't be talking ceasefire here. We would not. Unless by some miracle, the same scenario played out. But I don't believe she would have stood up. She doesn't have that spine or mental fortitude or principles of any sort that I can find. Now, granted, that's weird to say that Trump is like this principled, strong-willed man. Well, he is a strong-willed man and maybe is a man more of principle than anything else. Or maybe he doesn't want to be called a liar. I don't know. But ultimately, it worked this time, which is rare. Which to me justifies my concern about regime change war. And no matter what Ben Shapiro says, that we should be on our toes the next time something like this happens. The idea that you can't get out in front of something like this and voice your concerns to try to prevent the worst from happening is also a dumb thing. Come on, Ben. You know that these people are trying to prevent war from happening. It's not like they love, and it's the other thing. It's not like they suddenly love Iran or sympathetic to Hamas or something like that just because you care about human beings in Palestine or Gaza, however you want to say it. Give me a break. So, and then just to knock them down and put Tucker and Dave Smith on blast for these things, for voicing concerns. You can be wrong and still be right in being wrong at the same time. Does that make any sense? I think you know what I'm saying, though. Being overly concerned or vigilant about war powers and our country falling into another 10, 15 year war, that is something you should be shouting about. And even if you're out over your skis on it, that's in a good direction. It's not a bad thing to be trying to put the safety on the weapon that's pointed at the head of thousands of human beings, maybe millions of human beings, and even at the health and strength of your own nation. Those are the things that are on the chopping block here if we get into another long quagmire of a war. The fact that it didn't happen, kudos to you, Ben, for apparently knowing or suspecting that it would never devolve into that sort of tragedy. But that doesn't mean you get to then wave away and dismiss all the people who are concerned. I guess that's my point. And I think that concern will never go away until we start addressing the rules that I've just brought up here in the Constitution. These things matter. And we can't sit here and pretend like, as much as Trump, you know, people are going to hate him, he was right in this instance, apparently, for now, and that, you know, but we're not always going to be that lucky. And we might not always be that lucky with Trump in office. We might not be that lucky with the very next fucking president in office. So, read your rule book, folks. And more importantly, thank your lucky stars we're not at war right now. At least for today. I mean, who knows? I'm going to have to come back next week and, you know, just start by blubbering and crying because the nuclear bombs have fallen. I have no idea what's going to happen. I'd love to be back sooner than later with maybe some good news. Maybe I can come back and talk about more about the youth. I can always talk about the youth, the use of a military force and the authorization of such. Or, you know, maybe talk about the unitary executive theory, which is like, I think that's like a Heritage Foundation Project 2025 thing. I'm not 100% sure, but to me, it sounds like a George Carlin euphemism for a king. You have a king, or you have the unitary executive theory. Pretty stupid. Anyways, thanks all for tuning in. Go ahead and check us out at the ground level. And once again, really, I encourage you. I mean, I don't care if you like or even if you don't like the show, if you've stumbled across it and you go, this guy's an idiot, I'm going to put him on blast. Leave a comment that I can respond to because I think that would be fun. And if you want to check back in, I'll answer a question. Sean and I will answer a question. I just think that would be a good time to engage with like the three listeners I have, you know, maybe two. Maybe it's just one that's not family. I have no idea. Anyways, speaking of family, give him a call. Hug your mom, hug your sister, hug your son, hug your daughter, whoever you got. Give them an extra long one. You know, be grateful for the time you have on this planet. It doesn't last that long. And hopefully we'll talk with you soon. Later, y'all.